The Reserve Bank cut interest rates by 25 basis points today, 2.25, the official rate. Great news for homeowners, not so great for self-funded retirees. Iron ore, oil prices certainly been on the slide. Where would smart investors put money? Forget retail, suggests Roger Montgomery. He thinks the growth areas are going to be telcos, data and healthcare. The stock market rudely healthy just at the moment. It's been 7 or 8 days of fun.
I think, it's been 9, Tony, and it's been on an absolute tear. It surprised me just how strong it is. But it's really important to understand what's underneath it.
Yes.
And that's what we're going to talk about tonight.
I think so. We have Commonwealth Bank, the highest I've seen it in yonks. It was in excess
of... What's the highest? It's over $90 today. It was the highest it's ever been.
As I said a little bit earlier, if the Commonwealth Bank goes out of business, I think we're all in trouble. So
yeah,
I dare
right.
say it's probably a safer bet than the relatively modest interest rate. And the interesting speculation that is in the papers tomorrow, they're suggesting that even though 2.25% seems like a very low interest rate, there is projection that it could be 1.75% by Christmas as a cash rate.
Well, I in fact mentioned to Ros Childs on the Midday News yesterday here at the ABC that I didn't expect them to cut today. I thought that they would keep their powder dry and cut by a larger margin later in the year. So I do think that there's room to cut, but I was surprised because I don't really think that 25 basis points moves the dial for anyone. If you can borrow money at 4%, is it going to make a difference if it's 3.8 or 3.9? It's not going to make that much difference to you. So as interest rates get lower, the elasticity of demand for loans it reduces. People don't care that much. They become more inelastic. And so that's why I thought they might make a bigger, more dramatic move later in the year.
Mm. Do you think 1.75 for a cash rate at Christmas is likely?
Quite possible. Where Australia's in potentially for a hard landing. You don't go cutting rates when things are good.
No.
In Australia, what we've got is a number of issues. We've got GDP or economic growth as measured by gross domestic product. It's growing at less than trend rates, so it's growing at a rate that the RBA is uncomfortable with. We've got unemployment that's now expected to spike at a higher rate than previously expected.
Yeah, so 6.3%, I think, was their hope as a peak.
Well, it's going to go beyond that.
Yeah.
And why? Well, partly because China is slowing down so dramatically. The number of jobs in the resource and materials sector and the mining services sector, those jobs are disappearing at a great rate of knots, and they're not being taken up anywhere else.
Growth of 7.3% that they published just a short time ago doesn't sound that depressing, but you're saying that observers of the economy say that it could potentially be a lot worse than the official figure is saying.
Well, it's already lower than that, Tony. It's not 7.3%. Yeah. It wasn't 12% when they were reporting 12%. They've got some very curious ways of reporting growth. For example, their retail sales figures are actually not calculated when anyone buys a product. The retail sales number is produced when the goods leave the factory. So even though they might be building inventory in a warehouse somewhere, they're counted as retail sales. So the economy is growing at less than 7% already. And it's always curious in a country as disparate as China that they can come up with a GDP number faster at the end of the month than the United States can. I find that absolutely remarkable. So I'm very doubtful about the accuracy of those numbers. But that means lower jobs for Australia. So we've got higher unemployment. We've also got a declining terms of trade. Now, a lot of people might know what that actually means. They might not know what that means. And essentially, if terms of trade are declining, it means that we've got a greater amount of exports required to service or support a fixed amount of imports. So we've got to sell more to fund the same level of imports. Yeah. It means our net income is going down, which is why the RBA cut rates today.
Are you surprised by BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto continuing pretty adventurous production levels of iron ore when the price is dropping?
No, not at all. This is the normal commodity cycle. As commodity prices drop, and in this case we're talking about iron ore, as the price falls, then what happens is the marginal players, the small players with a very high cost of production, they stop production straight away. They lay off staff. So immediately what the players, the big players who've got lower costs of production do is take that market share away from them and try and take it permanently. So they produce more, lowering the price, pushing the bit players away. And it happens in retail as well in a recession. The Harvey Normans of the world and the JB Hi-Fis, they lower their prices, they reduce their margins, and they put the bit players out of business. And that's what's happening here. Yeah. So production continues to go up, even though the price goes down. Now, what investors have to remember before they launch into buying, and they did it this afternoon, Tony, buying BHP and Rio just because interest rates went down, what they have to remember is the iron ore price is in the 60s at the moment. But for 30 years before 2004, it traded between $10 and $20 a tonne. Between 2004 and 2011, it rallied all the way up to $187 a tonne, and that was the resource boom that Australia enjoyed.
Yep.
And so many experts said this is the new normal. This is we've reached a permanently high plateau, and the price of iron ore is going to stay high for a very long time. And here we are now, from $187 a tonne back into the 60s. We could see 40s, we could see 30s, we could see even lower. And that means that the profits for these companies may actually drop substantially.
Yeah. Obviously, we've been tracking the oil price declining, and that certainly helps our cost of living, because fuel prices do flow through.
Well, it's a big part of how much we spend each week, isn't it?
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, oil, and it's been tracking along with gas and coal as well, which have both been
all
in a bit of a slump.
Which is great for Australia and consumers of oil, but it's not great for large economies that are producers of oil. They get less revenue. So what you've got is you've got one part of the world that's benefiting from lower oil prices, but you've got an even bigger part of the world that's suffering from low oil prices. So on a global level, what we'll actually find is that the adjustment from the decline in oil prices for the companies that depend on revenue from oil, the adjustment there happens quicker, and it's an adverse adjustment. The adjustment for us, the benefit for us, happens a lot slower. In between those two things, you get recessions. And so we could have a really significant global slowdown because of this significant drop in the price of commodities.
I would say the thing that really surprised was the drop in the ruble. The Russian ruble fell 35% in December.
Well, there you go, because the oil price, they're largely dependent on oil revenues. Mm. And how do they service their debts and their borrowings if they're not getting the revenue from oil?
Yep.
It's a huge problem.
And we've seen a sort of almost a shift as far as where oil's been coming from of recent times, because obviously the Americans are very keen to become self-sufficient as they possibly can, and that shale oil is a big player these days.
Well, shale oil is more expensive to extract than conventional oil reserves.
So, OPEC putting a little bit of a squeeze on them?
That's exactly what's happening. And so this is a price war between OPEC and the United States. OPEC believes that if they keep the oil price low for long enough, then it will make it unviable to produce shale oil. And a lot of people will be laid off. They'll get jobs elsewhere. They won't come back. And that will benefit, in the long run, that will benefit conventional oil producers.
One big problem for Australians who are on fixed incomes is that trying to look for an interest rate that's safe is going to be a little tricky over the next little while. When you look around the world, there's hardly any high interest rates anywhere. I mean,
Greece is about the only place.
Yes,
Greece bonds are offering. Greek bonds are offering about 10.5% or thereabouts.
Good luck with that one.
Yeah, and that compares. Well, it's interesting. Robert Shiller came out, you know, the Nobel laureate. He came out and said that now is the time to be buying Greek assets. Mm. 10.5% for a Greek bond is pretty interesting when you consider that Mexico's on 3% and Italy's on 1.6% and Spain's on 1.4% or 1.5%. So 10% for Greece seems, on a risk-reward basis, reasonably attractive.
Yes, the Acropolis is probably up for sale just at the moment.
I think everything's up for sale in Greece.
Anything could be possible. The other issue, of course, is, and this is something that's also happened in the last month while you've been away, we've seen the Europeans instigate this quantitative easing program,
yes.
And that would probably normally mean that the euro will be going even lower than it is at the moment, I'm sure particularly the southern European countries would be welcoming, as well as Germany.
Well, the idea is, you know, and I'm not sure everyone understands quantitative easing. You know, it's an easy thing to throw out there, but what it actually means is when interest rates are at zero, effectively, you can't lower rates anymore. You can't make money any cheaper. So what you do is you just give people more money.
Print more.
That's basically it. Mm. The problem is that quantitative easing, when tried in the United States, took a long, long time. It's only just starting to find its way into consumers' hands. The money was held in the banks as reserves, and it wasn't lent out. The banks were reluctant to lend. So in Europe, they're going to find the same problems. They're going to find that they have to get the money into the hands of consumers to avoid deflation. Nobody wants deflation. That's not a good thing.
Where is the Australian economy at the moment? We have had a pretty good run. I think we've probably, about 20 years of...
didn't the Labor treasurer get treasurer of, you know, lifetime treasurer of the world, you know, star treasurer or something like that?
Pretty sure that was the case.
Something like that.
We're still just keeping our head ahead of the game at the moment, but things could be a bit rocky in the next couple of years.
Again, Tony, the reason why rates were cut today is because things aren't good.
Yeah.
And you know, as I said earlier, we've got low GDP, we've got declining income, our terms of trade are deteriorating, unemployment is rising. If you talk to retailers, and I've talked to lots of retailers, particularly over the summer break, you know, they just didn't see the sorts of traffic that they've seen in previous years. People simply weren't in the shops. The CBA conducted a survey just before Christmas. Christmas spending intentions were expected to be less than the year before. And that all flowed through. We've seen the Reject Shop warn that their results wouldn't be as good. We saw Kathmandu produce its first loss since it's listed as a company. There are lots of companies that are now producing results. Oriton was another one, producing results that are terrible. And this all comes back, Tony, and I said this the last time I was on the program, this all comes back to the idea that for years and years, federal governments, have done very little about creating industries to absorb shocks in other industries. Mm. So when people all lose their jobs at Ford plants and Holden plants, where else do they go? There's no major production industry. There's no manufacturing industry. You know, retail's suffering at the moment, so no one can get jobs there. It's all really, really tough, and that's why you're seeing interest rates with a 2% in front of it and potentially a 1%, because things aren't going as well as what we'd like.
What can you do, or should they have really been moving towards this a couple of years ago?
Should have been moving towards it 20 years ago.
I have to say, we did a program in Perth one night saying we're in boom conditions at the moment. This was about a couple of years ago.
Yep.
And we said, okay, we're in boom. It's not going to last forever. You know, what are we doing to ensure that we carry on
afterwards, exactly.
After the iron ore starts to fall away. And it seemed like no one believed that it would ever happen.
They didn't believe it would end. And again, not blowing my own trumpet, but just a simple fact. I remember having a debate with Tiki Fullerton on Late Line Business with the CFO of Fortescue Metals Group. And he said the long-term price of iron ore would be circa $100. That was the stable floor for the price. And that's just nonsense. You know, you never ask a barber whether you need a haircut. And you know, here we are. The commodities are cyclical. And unfortunately, I had breakfast with Andrew Robb now about 2 years ago. And I asked him, you know, what's the LNP's
plan? What's the plan?
What's the plan? And he said, we're going to play to our strengths. And I asked him what that was. And he said it was going to be resources and agriculture. Well, give me a break. You know, the reality is that their commodities, by definition, people buy them based only on price. BHP can't approach China and say, yes, but we've got very good quality iron ore. We want you to pay more for our iron ore. There's a global price and we're price takers. There's no competitive advantage other than maybe our geographical proximity. But when prices go down and the oil price goes down, suddenly South America becomes economical to buy iron ore from, and you can ship it to China, and, you know, suddenly there's no competitive advantage. We've got to add value to our exports, and we're just not doing it.
You have to say that almost identical things have happened to identically shaped countries. Canada is very similar to Australia in its exports and the way it runs. Brazil also very similar. And the three countries have all headed south as far as the currency is concerned. Obviously, today with the 0.25% cut in the interest rate, we saw an immediate 1.5 cent drop in the US to the US dollar. Mm. Where's the currency heading next?
Well, I believe, and look, I can tell you what I'm doing personally. So, yep. some years ago now, probably 3 years ago, I think the currency was at $1 or $1.02, and I remember putting my wife's and my personal wealth, our cash wealth, so our liquid yep. funds, into term deposits in US dollars, Singapore dollars, and British pounds. That's what we did. And I believe that long term, we couldn't sustain a currency that high because it was simply uncompetitive. So I believe that the regulators and the Reserve Bank of Australia and the government would do all that they could to see that currency come down. Glenn Stevens came out today and he said that the Australian dollar was still above what he believed it was worth, and particularly given commodity prices dropping. And he now believes that, and he's previously said that he thinks that the Australian dollar should be in the low 70s or even the high 60s. And I think at the end of the year, we might see the currency at that level. Now, I'll bring it back to what I'm doing personally.
Yep.
I'm not unwinding those positions that I've got personally in those currencies in foreign denominations. So I'm not going to buy the currency back at this point. I still believe we'll see lower levels because I don't believe that we can sustain the gap in interest rates in Australia compared to the rest of the world. Our economy doesn't justify it and commodity prices continue to fall.
It seemed to have fallen substantially in against the US dollar, against other currencies not so much. Do you see that continuing?
Well, we're not doing a good job against the New Zealand currency.
When I was away in December, January, it was almost a battle to see which was higher, the New Zealand dollar or the Australian dollar. It was
you go to New Zealand and things are going quite well. You know, they've got a plan. They've built a brand around what they think their competitive advantages are, and they're selling brand New Zealand. You know, I don't think we know what our brand is. All the forces are conspiring against the Australian dollar. You've got a slowing global economy. You've got China slowing down. Commodity prices are dropping. And a high rate is uncompetitive for us.
A quick SMS here. Question for Roger. For a safer investment, would index funds be a good alternative to blue chip dividend stocks?
I think that might be true in the very long run. But when we talk about blue chips, let me correct people's view on blue chips. There's a large number of companies listed in Australia that are regarded as blue chip that are basically rubbish. And they produce very, very poor returns over the long run. There are lots of companies, and I'll name a couple, the National Australia Bank, AMP. There's quite a few companies that have produced in the past poor returns for their shareholders. And in fact, over 10 years, Leighton's, Boral, there's a number of others, Qantas, Virgin. And over 10 years, their share prices today are lower than where they were 10 years ago. Now, they've been described variously as blue chip companies, and they're not. But if I was to class at the moment as blue chip, say, Telstra and the banks, then I would say while interest rates remain low and their dividend yields remain relatively higher, then you're probably going to find support for them over the medium term. And by that, I mean maybe 12 months to 18 months. After that, I just don't know.
You've got to say that, you know, if you look at a list of the blue chip stocks from the 1980s and compare it to 2015, a lot of the companies that were there in the 80s are no longer there.
Well, they're either they've generated such poor returns, as I said earlier, that their share price is lower. Mm. Now, there's a really interesting, if you give me a minute, Tony,
sure.
I can explain how to differentiate a good blue chip company from a bad blue chip company. And perhaps we can redefine what blue chips are.
By all means.
You need four things.
Yep.
Only four things. You need to know the change in debt over time.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know the change in the equity on the balance sheet over time and whether that's increased by capital raising, so additional shares being issued or retained earnings. You want to know the change in profit over time. and you want to know what the return on equity has been over time. Now, let me tie all those four things together to give you a story. So if we take, for example, an airline like Virgin Australia Holdings or Qantas, then what we actually find is that they had, let's call it $100 million of equity 10 years ago. And since that time, they've raised a lot of capital and they've now got, let's say, $1 billion of equity.
Yeah.
It's actually, the numbers aren't quite right, but I'm just going to use round numbers so everyone understands the picture. Now, if you had $100 million in your bank account 10 years ago, Tony, and you've raised money from friends and family, and you've now been given $1 billion of equity in your bank account, well, your interest is going to go up. Your interest revenue, your interest profit is going to go up. In fact, it's all profit because you really only need a rocking chair to run that business.
Mm.
So your profit should have risen. Now, airlines, and there are many other businesses that have done this, I've named a few earlier, they've had the benefit of extra equity capital being given to them through altruistic shareholders, and yet their profits haven't gone up. Their profits have gone down, even though they've been given more money. Now, that's just a disaster. You can do better than that with a bank account and a rocking chair.
I've got to say, you look at the breakdown of the Virgin shareholders and they're just about all other airlines.
Well, that's probably right now because no one
Etihad,
in their right mind.
I think Singapore, they're all
Warren Buffett airlines. Warren Buffett famously said many years ago, with respect to investing in airlines, a very famous quote, he said, "Had I been at Kitty Hawk in 1908 or whenever it was that Orville Wright took off, I hope I would have had the presence of mind for all future capitalists to have shot him down." So we've talked about two things.
Yes.
We've talked about equity. We've talked about the profit. Mm. Now, you can look at any company. You can get the annual report from 10 years ago or 5 years ago.
Yep.
You can look at the equity then. You could look at the equity today. You look at the profit then and the profit today. And you want the profit to be growing faster than the equity. If you give a company more money, they should earn more money on that. But many, many what are called blue chip companies do the reverse. You give them more money and they seem to be earning less. On top of that, the debt has gone up for many of these businesses as well. So they've gone to the banks and borrowed more money. And despite borrowing more money, they're earning less. And overall, the return on equity, when you compare the profit to the equity, the return on equity has been in decline. If a bank gives you a return on equity on your equity of 3% or 4%, then you want to get a better return on your equity for taking on the risk of owning a business. So businesses that earn low rates of return on equity simply aren't worth the risk. So we don't invest in those types of businesses, and I'm suggesting that no one should.
Also an interesting issue is gold. It's, according to an SMS here, $160 below its all-time high of $1,800 Australian. I think it did go a bit higher than that.
Yeah, yeah. US dollars, yes, it did.
Yeah. He's saying, is this something that people should have in the portfolio if things are going to be rocky?
I every year I buy a little bit of gold for my family, 1 ounce. And that's it. And it's a novelty. There was a great way to think about the difference between investing and speculating, and gold is the perfect example. So if you melded together all the gold in the world, it would form a cube of about 68 feet per side. You could fit it into a baseball infield. I'm quoting Warren Buffett here. You could fit it into a baseball infield. Now,
Now
here was an interesting thing. In Warren Buffett's letter a couple of years ago to shareholders at Berkshire Hathaway, he said, "What can you do with that cube of gold? You can fondle it, but that's about it."
Yeah.
And that raised a few questions in my mind because I thought, well, what's it worth? And at the time when gold was about $1,800 an ounce, I think he said that it was worth something like $9 trillion, that gold. And what could you do with $9 trillion? You could buy all the agricultural land in the United States, which produces hundreds of billions of dollars of revenue each year. You could buy all the real estate in Manhattan and still have many, many trillions of dollars left over. And that would buy you something like 16 ExxonMobils, which is the most profitable company in the world. And in 100 years' time, think about all the income those assets would have produced. And what would that cube of gold be doing in 100 years' time? It would still be sitting on that baseball infield and people would still be walking past stroking it, and it does nothing else. And so really to make money out of gold, you have to simply speculate on what other people might be willing to pay for it in the future. And that's not investing, that's speculation.
Berkshire Hathaway, what is it for a single share in that particular
thing? The last time I looked, I think it got up to $200,000 a share or something like that. We could look that up in a short space of time. But
obviously not a lot of people sell.
Yeah, all he did, by the way, and it's not a, it's been a very difficult task to achieve.
Yeah.
But what he's basically done is at Berkshire Hathaway, he's earned a very high rate of return on the equity on the bank account, if you like, earned a very high rate of about 21% and then not paid any dividends, retained the profits and earned 21%. So it's been a compounding machine at about 20% for something like 5 decades. Now, there are companies in Australia that have done that. There are companies in the United States that have done that, and you can buy them for less than $200,000 a piece. But it's really important to understand the economics that have produced that share price. It's simply been high rates of return on equity and no dividends being paid.
Understood, but I got to say, it's impressive, 200,000.
20% a year for 50 years is impressive.
Whoa. Julianne says, I'm going to the United States in a couple of months' time. Should I buy dollars now, given the Aussie seems to be dropping?
Look, I've done very, very well financially, believing the Aussie dollar would fall over 3 years. I really couldn't tell you, Tony, what it's going to do over 3 months. You know, that really is speculation. I think the bias is to the downside, but I really couldn't tell you whether or not in March it's going to be higher or lower than where it is today. I think it's more likely to be lower, but who knows?
Yeah. I'm just wondering whether you'd like to join us. Roger Montgomery from the Montgomery Fund is with us tonight. We have been talking about developments, and there have been a lot since the beginning of 2015. Interest rate announcement today, absolutely landmark, and suggestions that 1.75% interest could be the cash rate by the end of the year. So we're readjusting our sights at the moment. The stock market's gone a little bit crazy with 7 or 8 or 9 really good days in a row, despite the fact that the American market hasn't been going so well. If you would like to come in and talk about anything to do with your money, your interest, your future, love to hear from you tonight. John, you are saying falling interest rates. What about the impact on a credit card?
Well, the thing is, I've got a friend of mine that owes $20,000 on a credit card. And he was telling me that the banks have been taking most of the money that they've been paying off his goods and not the cash because it was a higher rate. And they have not reduced their interest rates on anything at all in the last 2 years.
Well, I'm not surprised by that, considering the banks are reporting record profits every single year.
Yeah.
You would expect that the most expensive, the most expensive interest rate is going to be on credit cards, and the reason being that, of course, the banks believe that that's the riskier end of lending, and so they're going to charge the most. It would make more sense. And Paul Clitheroe is probably a better man than me to actually suggest that this is right. But you're probably, given interest rates are so low, better off borrowing a little bit against the house and paying off the credit card and paying a lower interest rate that way.
Well, do you know what they're charging? They're charging on their goods 14%, but on cash it's 21.5%.
Yeah, there you go.
That's dreadful.
It sure is. I agree with you.
That's why they're making big problems. Do you know what this man that I know, do you know that he's in such a bad way? I think he's going to kill himself.
Well, I hope that's not the case, and you better get him onto Lifeline if that's the case.
He's in a bad way.
John, there are ways of working around this, and if there are is a looming crisis with him, there are a lot of people who can provide direct financial advice. Centrelink has financial officers who will happily help him.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what, Tony, this man's a good bloke. But he took the money out in cash to pay cash to have repairs done to his house, and he didn't realise what he was getting into, and he's in a bad way, and he's in his 80s.
John, what you've got to do is get him to call Centrelink tomorrow, ask for a financial officer, and get him to get direct advice from Centrelink. They can actually even lend him the money and fix it that way.
I'm worried about him. Really.
There's a lot of solutions. You get on the phone to him tomorrow.
Yeah, get him to ring Centrelink tomorrow. Yeah, honestly, it's a big deal. David, you were saying the lower dollar, a lot of better for exports, but what about imports?
Yeah, well, it sounds a bit like the, well, it is the old J-curve argument that a lower dollar just miraculously makes exports more competitive when, of course, you know, they're restricted to an extent by inelastic supply. You can't just ramp it up versus when the dollar drops, we virtually instantly start paying more for everything we import. And we are in a country where we have just run current account deficits and have money borrowed overseas. Well, in Australia, the dollar drops, the debt goes up, the payments on the debt go up.
Correct.
David,
I was talking about the terms of trade earlier. You know, they're deteriorating, and I've previously talked to Tony here on the program about the current account deficit. It takes... Now I think it's something like 6 or 7 tonnes of exported iron ore to pay for one iPhone. You know, and this is the problem. What are we exporting? We're exporting low-rent products. You know, we're exporting things that people don't pay a lot of money for, and they don't really care about the brand of that product. We really don't have a really significant export industry. If the government actually put its head together years and years ago and allowed startup businesses some sort of a tax break so that we could work out what we're actually good at adding value to our exports, then we'd find now we'd have a big industry somewhere that would actually be able to pay off the difference between our exports and imports, such that we wouldn't actually have to be selling our farms and businesses to pay for it. Now, it's Liberal Party ideology. They don't allow borrowing. They don't like borrowing. So they prefer to sell assets. So we're actually selling the farm to pay for the Xbox. And I think that's wrong.
And I think when we decrease the value of the currency, it only makes our assets cheaper to the whole rest of the world to come in and buy. And I mean,
correct,
real estate is a classic example of it, which I think virtually negates monetary policy altogether. You drop interest rates and housing prices simply boom, and that's all you achieve. And I think that's largely driven by overseas investment. Your dollar drops, it's just more bargain basement prices versus what the domestic person has to pay.
We've been sold this promise that by selling our businesses and our farms to overseas concerns, they'll bring new ideas and new investment to Australia. The problem is that through the FTA agreement with China, Andrew Robb wants to allow, or has allowed, foreign workers to come and work on those businesses that the foreign owners have bought in Australia. And he says that we're going to preserve Australian labour conditions. Well, that might be true, but that's not going to be for Australians' jobs. You know, it's going to be for jobs elsewhere. So you create a closed loop where a foreign owner of a business is using land in Australia to produce goods that will be shipped overseas that are actually manufactured by overseas staff working in Australia who are going to ship their income back overseas as well, because they're going to live in closed villages in Australia where all the services are provided by that owner. So I really worry for our long-term future, and I really think we've been sold a pup.
Yeah, and the I heard recently that they're talking about reintroducing that the thing that was called the MUA
yes,
a few years ago, whereby foreign businesses could sue the government if changes were made, you know, subsequent to
To the purchase of the business.
Yeah, a business decision.
On the terms. Yeah, that's right.
Well, they're trying to remove business.
Look, there is a solution. There is a solution, but no government's been willing to take it on, simply because I think, and this comes back to what's going on with Tony Abbott at the moment, you know, I think a 3-year term is simply not long enough to get anything done in Australia. We have the Westminster system, and yet in the United Kingdom they have a 5-year term, and here we've got a 3-year term. You can't get anything done, and so it's very, very difficult to see the results of your efforts if you try and make major, major structural changes in Australia. No party's willing to do it.
Alrighty, thanks so much for the call. Rhonda, you ask a technical question, but an interesting one. The difference between deflation and stagnation.
Yes, and are we heading for either, or if the economy goes south?
I have a paper on my desk at the moment at the office, and I'm reading it at the moment, and it's called, it's entitled The Stock Market and Deflation. Deflation is a real problem, and I'll tell you why it's a problem, and it's existed in Japan for a long, long time. You see, if you're worried that the price of things are going to go up, you buy them now. And then you've got consumption, and then businesses have revenue, and they use that revenue to employ people, and people get income, and they go and spend money because they think the prices of things are going up, and there you've got this virtuous cycle. But in a deflation environment such as being experienced in Japan, if you think the price of things are going to go down in 6 months' time or 3 months' time or a year's time, you defer the purchase. You don't buy anything because you think it's going to be cheaper down the track. You end up only buying what you need. And then people aren't employed because businesses aren't making greater revenue. And then you've got a reverse of the situation that I described earlier. So deflation is a very nasty thing. It's not something that we want, but it's something we're staring into the eyes of right now.
Okay, that's scary, isn't it?
It sure is.
Yeah. Good luck, Rhonda. Thanks for that. Peter, you've been offered a change to a variable loan, and you're just wondering what to do.
Yes, we're with one bank, and sorry, I can't remember your guest's name.
Roger.
Roger, yeah, I'm sort of missing the show on and off as I'm in the truck. Yeah, we're on a fixed rate of about 5.4, roughly, it's about that. And we've been offered today 4.7, but I naturally assume it may go down a little bit more, but one's going from a fixed rate, it's an investment property,
yep.
And going to our own bank, and on a 4.7, but possibly a little bit less, should we do it or not?
Well, you haven't given me enough information because there'll be some sort of penalty if you're on a fixed rate with your existing bank. If you then go from a fixed rate to a variable rate, or you pay that loan out with somebody else, they're going to penalise you. You really need to have a look at the terms of the new loan and whether or not it's on the same basis. But let me say this, because a lot of people speculate on interest rates. It's very important. There's value in budgeting. So a lot of people say to me, well, I think interest rates are going down. I want to move to a variable rate rather than a fixed rate. But there is value in knowing what your payments are going to be for a long period of time. There's enough variables in life with people losing jobs and all that sort of thing that you don't need interest rates changing around on you as well. So I put some value in stock in the idea that it's worth knowing what you're going to pay, and it's better the devil you know.
Yeah, well, they're talking roughly about $3,000 to get out of it, to release it.
Right, so then there's a simple calculation that you need to do to work out how long it's going to take you to start being better off. Basically, it's the difference between the 4.7 and the 5.3 multiplied by the amount of your loan, and then you'll be able to work out how long it's going to take before you're better off after paying that $3,000 penalty.
Okay, well, talking to our own bank, they said 3 to 5 years we should be back, like we should have what we've cost us to get out.
How long is the new fixed term, how long is that for?
The fixed term's 25 years and we've had it 2.5 years.
So you've got a fixed loan for 25 years?
For 3 years. Yes.
Yeah, for 3 years. So you need to, so it's going to take you four or five, the bank's been telling you it's going to take 4 or 5 years before you're better off. So you're breaking even after 4 or 5 years, but the new rate is only fixed for 3 years. So what's the rate going to be at the end of 3 years?
Yeah. Well, that's the worry, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Well, now you've got some stuff to chew on anyway.
Yep. Yeah. All right, well, thank you very much.
All right, it's a pleasure. Pete, thanks for that. Good to hear from you. John, you say that, you know, the whole world seems to be in debt. You're wondering who's holding the IOUs.
Yeah, well, that's right. Roger, I just don't quite understand that. We're in trouble because we owe $600 billion, and Greece is in trouble, and America's got so much debt it can never replace. In fact, it seems that every country owes money, and I just want to know who's holding the IOUs.
Well, China has bought a lot of that debt. Right, so a lot of the US treasuries are owned by the Chinese, and that's where a lot of their foreign currency reserves are at the moment, US dollars.
And Japan owns a lot of the debt as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I thought Japan was in debt.
There are net lenders. There's been a lot of debt forgiveness for third world countries as well. And you might remember Bono from U2 was involved in that big debt forgiveness program some years ago.
Yeah.
See, you've got to remember what all of these countries believe they can do is inflate their way out of the debt, right? What do I mean by that? Well, through inflation, the value of your interest goes down. If you owe me a dollar today and I take 50 years to pay that dollar off, then the money I'm paying you in 50 years' time isn't worth as much as the money I'm paying you today.
Yeah.
But the debt has remained at a dollar. So many of them believe they're taking a huge gamble, borrowing all this money, believing that they'll be able to inflate their way out of it. And that's what they're trying to achieve.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for that. John, you were looking to know about the impact of low interest rates on risky investments.
Yeah, Roger, I'm trying to be a value investor. I've
yep.
read your book, which is great, and everybody should read it.
Thank you.
I reckon.
I didn't pay Tony for him to come on and say that.
I'm not your brother or friend or anything.
No.
Unfortunately, I don't know you. Wish I did. But I sort of feel like I'm an animal in the headlights because
yep.
everything seems to be quite expensive at the moment,
yes.
Because I think everything's sort of being priced on abnormally low rates.
Correct.
But are forcing people into the risky investment, so it's pushing the values up. You know, PE expansion. It feels to me like it's sowing the seeds of the next bubble.
Yes,
and,
correct.
You know, and we've got, we've still got in the background technology disruption sort of happening everywhere and business models under pressure.
Correct.
So
that's what I was saying earlier. You've got earnings under pressure because the economy is actually slowing, but because interest rates are so low, investors are desperate to get a higher yield somewhere, and they're being herded into a narrower and narrower band of stocks, which is pushing their prices up. But just remember this one simple rule, and putting aside the fact that you have to be patient, but remember this, the higher the price you pay, the lower your return's going to be. Simple as that. So over the long run, the higher the price you pay for stocks, if you chase them, then you're going to have to expect a lower return in the future. I think we're in a low return environment because the prices, as you rightly point out, that are being paid for stocks at the moment seem to be very, very high. There's a couple of bright spots. There's a couple of companies that I think, Tony, are still relatively cheap. So investors can, if they want to go and investigate these themselves or seek financial advice, and I'm suggesting they must seek and take financial advice, but they're companies that I believe in the healthcare space. So companies like Medibank Private, CSL and Certex are worth researching. In the wealth management space, you've got companies like Challenger and Magellan. And businesses that are in the telco and data transportation and storage business, I think they're going to continue to do well. And you might find that they suffer less from the business cycle because people are consuming more and more data all the time. It's just going up on an exponential scale.
All right. John, good luck with that.
Thanks, John.
It's a difficult time. But we've got a board full of calls, and unfortunately we've run out of time. But thank you so much for being there, and hopefully catch up in the not-too-distant future.
Look forward to it.
It's Roger Montgomery from the Montgomery Fund, my guest tonight on The Nightlife.